time, I was just reading this book by Bruno Bettelheim, The Uses of Enchantment, so this is just particularly about this one book. It's in the Koinonia Library down at the end of the hallway here, so you can just look at it if you want to. Or, what is your name?
Karen.
Karen just bought this at the bookstore, and there are a few more there, too. And it was published last year, and has anyone read it? Lois, you have.
I haven't finished it. It was interrupted by a trip to Europe.
Oh.
I'm not
going to
say how to finish any book.
But nobody else. But it was just published last year. The first thing I had heard about it was a review in the New York Times Review of Books, and it was by John Updike, and who said that it was, you know, really great, except he kind of wondered about the Freudian interpretation of the fairy tales in the last half of the book. It was the winner of the National Book Award, and it was the winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award, so it has gotten quite a bit of publicity. And if you know Bruno Bettelheim at all, he's a psychologist, child psychologist, and psychiatrist at the University of Chicago, I understand, but spends his time between Chicago and California. He was born in 1903 in Vienna, received his doctorate at the University of Vienna, and came to America in 1939 after a year in Dachau and in Buchenwald. And so, but he has done quite a bit of work. Have anyone read any of his other books? Dialogue with Mothers. And he has one that has just come out, I think, on children raised in communal type family arrangements. I think that was his last one. And there are several others. He's especially known for his work with autistic children. Well, this book is divided kind of into two parts. The name of it is The Uses of Enchantment, The Meaning and Importance of Fairy Tales. Then the first part he's telling about the uses of fantasy or enchantment. And then the second part he takes individual fairy tales and then he just goes through and analyzes them. Well, with all of the talk about fantasy, space wars as the space fantasy, and all of the other types of fantasy that we're reading, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and so forth, this is a very interesting book, just particularly then about fairy tales. It's, I think I'll just go through with his point of view, and you can interrupt or you can say anything as we go through. And I'm not sure just exactly what my point of view is yet about this. I really have just finished reading it not long ago. He starts out and says that the struggle for meaning is one of the big parts of our existence, coming to a conscious realization of meaning in our lives. And so he says that that comes with psychological maturity, finding out what the meaning in our life is. And as we raise children, that is also with the task of trying to help them find meaning in their lives. Well, he says that parents, of course, are the first ones that are the ones that really do this. Other beyond that, he says, it is our cultural heritage, which he says can be transmitted most in the best way by literature. And he says then that fairy tales are the way to do this. And so he says that thinking about all of the whole range of children's literature, with rare exceptions, and he doesn't name them, he says nothing can be as enriching and satisfying to child and adult alike as fairy tales. And says because life is so often bewildering to the child, you have to learn somehow to get meaning or to get order out of the chaos of your life, that that you need to be helped to make sense out of this turmoil. And so in this book then he is struggling with the question, why is it that fairy tales then appeal so much and are so helpful to children in finding meaning in their lives? So what he's really doing is taking the psychological meaning of fairy tales and dealing just with those, says that there could be, well, for instance, he talks about some of the psychological problems of growing up. He calls them, in Freudian terms, overcoming narcissistic disappointments, Oedipal dilemmas, sibling rivalries, being able to relinquish your childhood dependencies, gaining a sense of selfhood, a feeling of selfhood and of self-worth, gaining a sense of moral obligation, all of these things the child needs to go through his unconscious and cope with what is going on there, and then bring it into a conscious level and try and sort it out by either ruminating or rearranging or fantasizing in some way to do that. And he says that fairy tales here are of unequaled value, because he says that what you have is that so much is the unconscious. In the fairy tales, these unconscious feelings and so forth are externalized into a story. There is a widespread notion that you should try and keep a child from finding out what it is that is troubling him. What are these formless, nameless kind of anxieties that a child has? And many parents believe then that only very conscious and very reality, pleasant reality kind of things should be presented to the child. And I'm not sure if this is all true, but this is what he is saying, that there's a widespread refusal to let the children know that the source of much of what goes wrong with him is inside himself. And acting aggressively or asocially or selfishly or out of anger or hostility and so forth. Instead, we want our children to believe that they are all good inside. And even when children know that they're not good, then you have this kind of contradiction there. The dominant culture, he says, wants to show that the dark side does not exist. Now, maybe you want to disagree with that whole premise of what he is saying. He says that psychoanalysis then has enabled man to accept kind of the problematic nature of his life without being defeated by it. And he goes on to say that Freud then is saying that only by struggling courageously with what seems like just overwhelming odds can a person get some meaning out of his existence. And this is what he says is the message that fairy tales get across. He says that the fairy tale just confronts the child right away with a basic human dilemma. For instance, it may begin with the death of a father or a mother, or the death of a father or of a parent creates some kind of agonizing problem, or the fear of it. Or otherwise, you may have an aging parent who decides that it's time for the child to take over, to rule the kingdom, or so forth. But before this can happen, then the child has to go through something to prove himself capable and trustworthy. You've got various fairy tales like that. Anyway, the existential dilemma is kind of presented right away, very clear and to the point. The fairy tale simplifies all the situations. You have evil just as omnipresent as good in most of the fairy tales. Evil is not without its attractions, and for a time, evil may be what is temporarily in control. For instance, the wicked sisters in Cinderella and others that you can mention. But the figures aren't ambivalent. They are either good or evil. It is the very polarized. There's nothing kind of in between the good and the bad. Or the virtuous sister and the industrious sister and the lazy one. Or the beautiful one and the ugly one. He says that by presenting the polarities then in the characterizations, the child can comprehend the difference between good and evil, which he couldn't do if you have the ambiguities, which maybe later on, of course, you do have to deal with. And another characteristic of the fairy tale then is the happy ending. You have that if they have not died, they are still alive, and they lived happily ever after. you have this feeling that there is always the happy ending. They live for a long time afterwards, happy and in pleasure. Now, some people say that this is one of the things that is the matter with the fairy tales, this unrealistic wish fulfillment kind of thing. But he is saying that that consolation, that feeling of the happy ending, is very essential to fairy tales and for the child to be able to work out all of the things within him, knowing that there is that happy ending. Often the fairy tale hero proceeds for a while in isolation. He is the only one. He's been the one that has been let go, and maybe he's helped by being in touch with something in nature, a stick or a stone or an animal, something like this. The fate of these heroes convinced the child who's reading it then that he may feel outcast too, but that the happy ending will be there. So his purpose in the book then is to find out the psychological meanings. He said you could go in many other different directions. You could take it as the cultural heritage, and you could do it that way. You could do it as the folklorist would do and find out other things. You can have linguistic or literary critical, many other ways that you could go at fairy tales. You could do it for the moral education, or you could do it for the religious implications that are in fairy tales. And there are, of course, many other people that have taken fairy tales and gone through them and found out what they have to offer. But he is just saying primarily it's the psychological that he is going to find out why fairy tales are so helpful to people just helping them to maybe integrate their personality or achieve wholeness, achieve meaning, and so forth. So he says that there are great psychological meaning for all different ages, children and adults as well. He says that if a parent should decide why his child likes a certain fairy tale at one particular time, that he should keep this to himself. He says that the child's most important experiences and reactions, especially here to fairy tales, are largely subconscious, and they should remain so until he decides that he wants to tell the parent about it. He says that it's always intrusive for the parent then to interpret to the child why he likes it, to make conscious what is unconscious in the child. And he says just as important for the child's well-being to know that, you know, that the parent shares his emotions and shares his feelings about the fairy tale is also the feeling that his inner thoughts aren't known to his parent. And if the parent indicates that he knows them, this gives the child the the feeling that what was secret and private to him isn't. And this feeling that the parent is always so much more powerful than the child which a child has, that the parent is so much more powerful, this feeling that maybe the parent is reading his inner mind is also very destructive. And so trying to explain to a child why he likes a particular fairy tale is, he says, is really bad. He says that you can find meaning in life and security when you have come to those realizations yourself, not when someone else has explained them to you. So that's a little bit of the introduction to the book. He goes on and talks a little bit about myth and legend. He says that throughout man's history, there have been myths and legends to explain many things, and he knows that there are many similar things between myths and legends and fairy tales. But he says that in a fairy tale, it's the internal processes that are externalized in a story. And he says that fairy tales don't intend to describe something that the world as it is, but They don't tell you what to do when one ought to do, but they are the internalizing. They are externalizing what is internal in the child. He says that the fairy tale makes no demands on the person at all. It's just a fairy tale. It isn't like a fable it has a very didactic kind of moral to it. This is what you should do or shouldn't do. He says that it never confronts you directly or tells you how you should choose. He says there's a lot in common, myths and fairy tales. The culture is presented. A myth may also describe inner conflict. But the myth confronts, the fairy tale just suggests. He says when he talks about myths and legends, he says that Plato, when he was talking, said that in his ideal republic, that all people should begin their education with the telling of myths. He says Aristotle too says the friend of wisdom is also a friend of myth. Now he may be using myth in a very large sense here. Speaking about the similarity between myths and fairy tales, for instance, Eliada, he's at the University of Chicago. I don't know what it is exactly that he does teach. But he describes all of these stories, myths and legends, as models for human behavior that give meaning and value to life. But he goes on and says that in most of these, they are parallels, or they give symbolic expression to initiation rites or other rites of passage, such as a metamorphic death of an old inadequate self in order to be reborn on a higher level. And he feels that this is why these tales meet a strongly felt need. He goes on to say it's impossible to deny that the ordeals and the adventures of the heroes and heroines of fairy tales are almost always translated into initiatory terms. Now, this seems to me to be of primary importance, this is what Eliada says, which is so difficult to determine. When fairy tales took place as such, men, both primitive and civilized alike, have listened to them with a pleasure susceptible of indefinite repetition. This amounts to saying that initiatory scenarios, even camouflaged as they are in fairy tales, are the expression of a psychodrama that answers to a deep need in the human being. Every man wants to experience certain perilous situations, to confront exceptional ordeals, to make his way into the other world, and he experiences this on the level of his imaginative life in hearing or reading fairy tales. But then Bettelheim goes on to say then more clearly on the difference between legends or myths and fairy tales is, as far as, you know, being as demanding and confronting or as being suggestive, also that the ending with most myths, or the whole character, is that they are absolutely unique. The other thing is that the ending is almost always tragic in a myth. And he says, for example, this is one reason why Hans Christian Andersen's Little Match Girl and The Steadfast Tin Soldiers are beautiful stories, but they aren't really fairy tales. They don't have the happy ending. He says that the myth is pessimistic while the fairy tale is always optimistic. It always has that happy ending. No matter how terrifying it might be, no matter how much terrifying it might be going through fighting the dragon and so forth, the ending is always optimistic, whereas myths aren't that way then. So he's just taking it, you know, very, very, in a very narrow sense of fairy tales, of what they are. The happy solution is one of the big parts of it. Another difference about the myth and the fairy tale, though, is that myths almost always have definite names. You've got the Theseus, you've got Hercules, you've got Beowulf, you've got Brunhild, you've got all myths with a very definite person, a very definite name, and even their fathers and mothers have names. In fairy tales, they are every man. It's a little girl who went into the forest. If it's Little Red Riding Hood, it's just because she happened to have a cape that was red. Or if you have Cinderella, it's because she sat by the cinders. Otherwise, and Hansel and Gretel are very, very, very common names. Otherwise, it's just a boy or a girl, the boy who went forth to learn fear. Their mothers and fathers don't have names at all. They're very ordinary kinds of people. If you have father, mother, stepmother, you might have a king and a queen who are another name really for the father and mother. You might have a prince or a princess, which is another name really for the child. But they're ordinary people, and as you're listening to him, as a child is listening to him, he is thinking most likely of himself. Then he goes on and takes some of the themes that are dealt with in fairy tales. For instance, the pleasure principle versus the reality principle. And then he takes the three little pigs in that one. He says the myth of Hercules also would go and have this, but the fairy story of the three little pigs is pleasure versus reality. Or you've got the problem of identity. who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? And so forth. It isn't so much is there going to be justice for everyone, but is there going to be justice for me? And let's see. Particularly, in dealing with some of these problems, your identity, pleasure versus reality principle, and so forth, is the importance of externalization. He says that the story begins with a very real kind of a problem, but still it's a very problematic kind of a problem. It isn't that you are thinking that it is you there at all. The beginning is always once upon a time, or in a certain country, or 1,000 years ago, or in a time when animals still talked, or once in an old castle, you know, in the midst of a very large and dense forest. It's some kind of a beginning that deliberately sets you in a vague kind of a place that you know that you are leaving the concrete world of reality. It's long ago. He talks about the Frog King, the Brothers Grimm, that starts off in olden times when wishing still helped. There lived a king whose daughters were all beautiful, but the youngest was so beautiful that the sun itself, which had seen so much, was astonished whenever it shone in her face. And the whole beginning in many of these is just set in that kind of in that kind of a setting. So the problem may be very internal, but the setting then is always in an external world of long ago. The ending almost always returns you to reality again. He says that the child needs the assurance that he can indulge in this kind of fantasy and return again. And he says that by telling fairy tales, a parent gives the child an important demonstration that the parent considers that the child's inner experiences as embodied in these fairy tales are worthwhile and are legitimate and in some sense are even real. G.K. Chesterton, in his book on orthodoxy, just has some marvelous things to say about fairy tales. He has a whole chapter here called The Ethics of Elfland. And he says, "My first and last philosophy, that which I believed in then and which I believed in now, I learned in the nursery, usually from a nursemaid." And then he goes on and says, these are the things that are called fairy tales. He said, "Fairyland is nothing but the sunny country of common sense. It is not earth that judges heaven, but heaven that judges earth. And so for me, at least, it was not earth that criticized Elfland, but it was Elfland that criticized the earth. I knew the magic beanstalk before I had tasted beans. I was sure of the man in the moon before I was certain of the moon. And he goes on to say then some of the things that he learned from fairy tales. And he said there is, he says there's the lesson of Cinderella, for instance, which is the same as that of the Magnificat. He has humbled those of low degree. There is the great lesson of Beauty and the Beast, that a thing must be loved before it is lovable. There's the terrible allegory of the Sleeping Beauty, which tells how the human creature was blessed with all birthday gifts, yet cursed with death, and how death may also perhaps be softened to a sleep. So he's talking about fairy tales as a certain way of looking at life. He says that so those are some of his reasons also for fairy tales. Then he goes on to say some of the ways, we're just talking about this particular book, some of the ways that this might happen. He talks about transformations, for instance, that like in Little Red Riding Hood, the kindly grandmother then suddenly is the wolf in bed. Or she's both grandma and the wolf, so to speak. The child can preserve his image of a kind and loving grandmother, even though at times she does seem like the wolf. At the end, she is the grandmother, and she'll return triumphant. And he says, far from being just a device that's used in fairy tales, he says that such a splitting up of one person into two to keep the good image contaminated occurs to many children as kind of a solution to a relationship that is just too hard to comprehend. And he goes on to talk about a girl who could take her mother when she was loving and kind, but when she became the scolding kind of mother, thought of her as the Martian. And she always thought of her as a Martian. She was sure that a Martian had come and taken form in her mother, and in that way she was able to live with it until she was at an age when she all of a sudden she realized that her mother knew everything that this Martian had done too, you know, and she was able to take both sides. I think this is another part of that polarization that of setting things into good and evil. A child maybe can't comprehend. Some of you that have done more work with children can, and so you split up. There are other ways too. For instance, you think, well, these aren't really your parents, you know. And there are stories then that maybe these are fantasies or daydreams too, in which you they center on the fact that your parents aren't really your parents, but that you are really the child of some great king or queen or something, and that someday, you know, you will be recognized. They are they're fantasies, and they're helpful, and they can be indulged in without guilt. You also have the fantasy of the evil stepmother and the good mother, and he gives one illustration. He says he's known young children who during the day are successfully dry all day, but at night wet their bed, and waking up they move with disgust to another corner and say, "Somebody's wet my bed." He doesn't do this to put some blame on somebody else, but it is part of the way that you have kind of parted company with that person that did it, with that aspect, and that has actually become kind of a stranger to him. There are other ways of trying to bring order into chaos, kind of through fairy tales, trying to bring some order into a world that is chaotic. He talks about in the Bible the first thing to overcome chaos, God divided light from darkness. And he is saying here too that one way of bringing order into this chaos is by dividing everything into opposites. And he says, of course, later on you have to be able to integrate too, but that this is he, of course, what he goes into then as far as bringing order into chaos is going into some Freudian terms of the id and the ego and the superego, and he goes through a lot of fairy tales dividing it up into that way, the id, the animal part of our nature, and he will do this like in The Wolf and Little Red Riding Hood and so forth. He does go on, a further part of bringing order into chaos is to try to achieve some kind of integration. You have quite a few fairy tales where you have two children, for instance, and both parts are necessary, the feminine, the masculine part of human nature, so forth. You've got many fairy tales that talk about this unifying your dual nature, achieving some kind of an integration. He talks quite a bit about the number three and what that could mean. I mean, it could mean this id, ego, and superego. It could also, there are also other things that that it could mean. For instance, he says that the number three, you have quite a bit on that. That he says that we're quite conscious that one usually stands for ourselves in relation to the world, and number two usually signifies maybe a couple or love or a marital relation or something. Three usually stands for the child himself, not usually in relationship to his siblings, even though it may be, you know, the three children of some kind, but usually as himself as a child in relationship to his parents. He does talk quite a bit about that number three that is used, and maybe there are all kinds of other numbers too that are important in fairy tales. He goes on to talk about Oedipal conflicts and resolutions. You have all of the fairy tales that you have, the knight in shining armor or the damsel in distress. In some way, the unnoticed little boy who goes out into the world and makes a great success of life. The details may differ, but the basic plot is the same. He slays the dragon, or he solves a riddle, or he, in some way, lives by his wits and his goodness until eventually he frees the beautiful princess and marries her and lives happily ever after. You have quite a few. Well, then he takes those as far as the Oedipal situation too, and goes into quite a bit of detail on those. When he talks about why, perhaps, this is maybe a little bit about that as far as the Oedipal conflicts. He says that mothers cannot accept their little boy's wishes to do away with daddy and marry the mother, but a mother can participate in a fairy tale in her son's imagining himself as the dragon slayer who gains possession of the beautiful princess. In other words, what he's saying is that the Oedipal conflicts are a necessary part of growing up, but that they have to be resolved in order to go on and live happily ever after and come through it. When he talks about why were fairy tales outlawed, or why have they not been used so much, he says that one big reason people say is that they don't tell the truth. They figure that they're lying to their children. And so that Bettelheim says, no, this isn't true. This isn't true at all. That right away at the beginning of the fairy tale, you have in Once Upon a Time, in Days of Yore, in Times and Tides Long Gone, you are setting that isn't the problem, whether it is true or not. You're putting it in a different world. He says that the truth of fairy stories is the truth of our imagination, not that of just the normal everyday life. Tolkien says, when asks the question, is it true, he says it is not one to be rashly or idly answered. Probably of more importance is the question, was he good or was he wicked? the child wants to know who's on the right side and who's on the wrong side. Another thing that Tolkien says is that often when the child says, is it true, what he maybe is saying, I like the story and everything, but is it contemporary? In other words, can I go to bed tonight, you know, without having to think that there are dragons? Well, then maybe the only answer is there's certainly no dragon in England today, you know. Somehow, fairy tales are not concerned so much with possibility, but with desirability. Tolkien also says, I had no desire to have either dreams or adventures like Alice, or the account of them just amused me. I had little desire to look for a buried treasure, or, you know, Treasure Island. But he said, the land of Merlin and Arthur was better than these, and best of all, the nameless north of Sigurd of the Volsungs and the prince of all dragons. Such lands were preeminently desirable. I never imagined that the dragon was of the same order as the horse. The dragon had the trademark of fairy written plainly upon him. In whatever world he had his being, it was of the other world. I desire dragons with a profound desire. Of course, I and my timid body did not wish to have them in my neighborhood, intruding on my relatively safe world. And so Bettelheim is saying, if you are really bothered by that question, is it true, you probably maybe shouldn't be telling fairy tales to your children. You have to be able to answer that question. Other people just fear that maybe the children will be carried away by their fantasies as to neglect learning to cope with reality. He also says that this isn't true, that he said if you have a wildly imaginative fantasy life, you can go through and settle those real conflicts and find reality much better. He says that Freud says that thought is an exploration of possibilities which avoids all of the dangers inherent in actual experimentation. So that just thinking about all things, means that you don't have to go out and do all things. In fantasy, in your imagination, the same way, you can be thinking through all of these things, and even as a scientist who can maybe play with all kinds of ideas before actually doing the experimenting with them. And fantasy, fairy tales is this way of playing with ideas. This was an interesting little thing. He says that he had done therapeutic work with one boy who had suddenly become mute, didn't talk at all. He said, my mother washed out my mouth with soap because of all the bad words I used, and those had been pretty bad, I guess. What she didn't know was that by washing out all the bad words, she also washed out all the good ones. And he isn't saying that that was the only cause of his problems or anything, but that there were many other things that had gone wrong. But in order to fantasize and to play with, to think about all of these things, you are able probably to come to the using the good ones. He is always using fairy tales. One section here is transcending infancy with the help of fantasy. It's always in the process of growing up and to be able to come to maturity. He talks about the maturity is often the kingdom, that you're going to become the ruler, that you're going to live, be the king and live happily ever after, marry the princess or something. And he says, what is this kingdom that many fairy tale heroes gain at this story's end? He says that really, we're never really told anything much about it at all, not even what the king or the queen does. There's no purpose in being the king or the queen other than just being the ruler. In other words, to have achieved independence, To become the king or the queen means that you've reached a state of independence, and the hero feels secure, satisfied, happy in that way, and that's what he says is the purpose of these things. He says he talks about modern stories a little bit, the little engine that could, saying, you know, you just keep on saying, I think I can, I think I can, and you'll be able to do it, just isn't very much help at all. He says Swiss Family Robinson, you can maybe think of as just escape, but there is a lot of stories that we have are in this way. But with the fairy tale, with this extravagant promise of a happy ending in fairyland, in your minds, the hope that the kingdom is going to be yours is a very important part of all of these. Another one that he talks about is Milne's poem, James Morrison Morrison. And here he's talking about the little boy that says, you know, James Morrison Morrison, whether it be James Dupree, told his mother something, never to go down to the end of the town if you don't go down with me. And the mother goes anyway, and she gets lost, and she never comes back. And I used to read that to the kids, and I used to kind of like that, too. But what he is saying about it is that it's really a very funny story, but it's only a funny story to adults. To the child, it gives body to his worst nightmares that could possibly happen. What seems funny to the adults is that you've got the mother, the parent and child relationship reversed here. And much as the child may want to have this reversed, to be the one that is guarding his mother instead of always being guarded, he just can't take this idea that the parent might be permanently lost, you know, as the outcome there. And so he is saying there that so much of the modern-day literature is this kind that really gives a real anxiety to children. This threat of separation, he says, is just one of the basic, you know, real anxieties in children, the separation anxiety that he, in fact, he says, I guess, that it is man's greatest fear, this fear of separation. He talks a little bit about Tolkien's, Tolkien's facets that he considers necessary in a fairy tale. The fantasy and the recovery, escape, and consolation. The recovery is just kind of the recovery of the wonder of this world. The escape is escape to another kind of world, but he is saying that this is a good thing to have, is this escape, and then finally the consolation, which is the greatest service that Bettelheim says, the consolation, this idea of the happy ending. Well, that is just the first part of the book, and then the second part of the book, he takes individual fairy tales. He takes Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, Jack and the Beanstalk, Snow White. He particularly takes this jealous queen in Snow White, and then he talks about the Oedipus story there, too. He takes Goldilocks and the Three Bears and Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella, and then the whole cycle of stories that are called animal groom stories, where the groom is an animal but becomes a man or a prince or something, either when the girl kisses him while he's still a pig, or loves him while he's still the beast, and then he becomes the prince. So he ends with that whole, well, when he goes, the first half of the book I thought was just marvelous. Then as he started going through the second part, I thought, you know, oh, he's really, really digging in for every single meaning that there could be. And really Freudian, it seemed like, all the way through, as far as the sexual part being the basic conflict or in a person. So you could go through many more of just those individual stories. I was thinking we would go through Hansel and Gretel a little bit, but maybe we won't. Let us just hear from some of you, some of your reactions, and some of your other ways to look at fairy tales. Yes.
Some of the fairy tales threatened me so much, and they still do, that I couldn't read them. One of them was The Ugly Duckling, and we had a lovely edition with nice pictures. Mm-hmm. But and of course that's why the children wanted to hear that all the time, and I have to say I just can't read it.
Uh-huh.
And the same with Hansel and Gretel. In fact, the parents took the children out to lose them,
mm-hmm.
and I still, at my age, threatened by those. This is ridiculous. Maybe my children were bothered,
uh-huh.
but there were a number of them that I feel very uncomfortable with. I was almost always in tears under the Ugly Duckling.
Yeah. Now, he does not think a lot of the Ugly Duckling. He says this just happens that you're going to happen to grow up to be a swan. It doesn't take anything on your part. He goes through and says that those where you have to struggle a little bit and go through things are better. And so he also does not like that Ugly Duckling. And he said also, wherever you think that you are so different from everybody all the time, too, that isn't the purpose, that should be the purpose, but that there should be this feeling that even though you are, you know, maybe by yourself or something, you will be able to do it on your own with the help maybe of some friendly animal or something, you know. But that is interesting. Yeah.
Did you say anything about the Grimm fairy tales? They are grim. I remember reading them as a middle school-aged child. My parents never read them to me. And I didn't think they ended well at all. I haven't gone back and reread them as an adult, but the feeling I have is I don't want to read those to my children either. They didn't end right.
Well, he says that the Grimm tales are very good. And that he says that fairy tales usually have, I mean, he goes into the whole oral tradition in the century. Some of them are just very, very old. Cinderella was probably from China or someplace like in about 800-900s. You know, there has been a long history of them. And he says it is the oral tradition that has built up. And he does think the Grimm ones, he says that the modern day ones and the Disney ones have just done away with everything, but that the Grimm version is are generally very good. Now that would be interesting to know specifically some of those endings. he says, for instance, Hans Christian Andersen, those are more modern day, and some of those may be good, the Snow Queen and so forth, but Ugly Duckling and Little Match Girl, and I can remember The Little Mermaid, or, you know, some of those were really sad ones, and he wouldn't consider them. So the ending is just very important to him.
Isn't the idea that in the end the hero copes with whatever the thing is?
Yeah.
No matter what the problem is, that the hero, and even no matter what the coping is, whether it's happily ever after or just, you know, something lesser than that.
Well,
the idea gives the child that, you know, even if your parents do abandon you, you can find a way back. You can.
Right.
I think I felt guilty because I probably wanted to do it.
Well, he does say that. He says that parents can't take this feeling that they may be thought of in the child's eyes as the ogre or as the evil stepmother or whatever, the witch or something. So he said many parents won't read to their children because they think that, you know, then they will be putting that idea in the child's head. He said, really, it's much more helpful to the child for you to be telling this story to, you know, in a way be letting them know that you know, too, that they may think of you in that way sometimes. The other thing about the happy ending is not only that it has to be the happy ending, but evil is punished. And you know, we don't like this. We'd rather have mercy. But, you know, this is always justice. You know, the evil is punished just as much, and so the evil, or the queen or something in Snow White is puts on these red hot slippers and dances until she dies or something, so that you have a two-part ending, and the brothers Grimm do this, I think. Gertrude?
I think it's very important that what he says in there about much as you like to help your children mm-hmm. with interpretation, you shouldn't do it at all. Just read it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they come back, because they grow into it and they're at different stages of their development, and as each stage progresses, they become a different character in this, and they work out their problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the good and evil is stretch. It's not preaching to them, but they see that there is punishment for
mm-hmm.
evil.
Mm-hmm.
And reward for the good. Mm-hmm. And this is what they can look at for themselves. If you don't bow to your interpret, you just read the story and let it be.
Yeah.
And they want them back and back. And if they think their mother is like the ogre or their brothers and sisters, they can understand that. But sometimes they are like that. And sometimes we are like that. This is real to them.
Yeah.
But then you change again. They come back and read you in a different way. Mm-hmm. You're not so bad.
Yeah. Did you? Yeah.
I just forgot to think about two people were there. Donald Hines lecture this morning on the legends of the Northwest Indians of this area, and how the Indian children are just saturated with legends. And then at the age of 7, with no interpretation, it didn't sound like they were just told the story again and again. And at the age of 7, they were taken on a two or three day trip into the wild, left by themselves without food, and they were told not to sleep, and they were to wait for the vision to come. And it was auto-suggestion, and they would identify then with one of the stories or legends that they had heard, and this then would become their, if it was the eagle that came to them and talked to them, then they would become the shaman or the medicine man. And so, or if it was a fish, then they became the fishermen. Mm-hmm. Or the different animals then, in identifying with them, would also say something about what they were to grow up to be and to become.
Yeah, I think he is saying too that you don't read it too young. He's like at the age 3, 4 or something, you know. Mm-hmm. It isn't that you open up a door and there's a dragon or something. It's a big enough story just to open, you know, that the boy went and opened up a door. 5, 6 years old, maybe he is saying that you're reading up through adolescence, really. He is saying it's the time for that. Now, I'm not sure.
Did you get a feeling that when he goes into the central part of it, that he is referring to what a lot of storytellers have done to them? And he gives some examples of people who have worked through them.
Mm-hmm.
I felt he was less inclined to just let the story be.
It could be, yeah.
Although I know he works with these children, children, and has helped hundreds of them.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't feel he himself felt that was such an essential part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Couldn't it be that maybe some of the fairy tales that are tragic or horrible to deal with also have a purpose, in that they can maybe help a child to experience a tragedy in his imagination before it happens, because there's always something that happens in life, you know, it doesn't always turn out happy. And I don't see why the definition of a fairy tale should be that it has a happy ending. Life isn't like that, and if a fairy tale is supposed to help a person to be prepared for life, then that some of them should be tragic or unpleasant or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Okay, fairy tales are so powerful in that they're a world apart, but I've seen like in Lassie, where there are situations that a child can identify with and they would be just terrifying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of protection that came in with a long time ago in a strange land with strange customs. But you see somebody with a child about their age, a dog, a mother and father, some kind of stress situation, something very threatening, and the child can identify with that. That's real.
Mm-hmm.
That could happen to them.
Yeah.
You think the idea of eternity, and as a Christian, has a significant here in here that life does go on.
I don't know about.
He doesn't come out.
He doesn't.
Some Christian ideas in it, but that may be part of the reason of the fairy tale, that it is not all over.
Uh huh.
And we wanted to refute that for a long time. That there's no life after that, and all of a sudden, it's very much in the thinking again.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
That may be part of the fairy tale, I think.
Tolkien is definitely in that when he's, you know, talking about the joyous turn, the sudden joyous turn, the happy ending, and kind of all fitting into the great happy ending, you know. But I didn't get that particularly in Bettelheim, probably. Mark, did you?
You've been mentioning that he kind of discounts Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah.
And other depth psychologists like Jung do also. And a couple of reasons for that. One is that Hans Christian Andersen was consciously concocting these stories.
Mm-hmm.
These weren't really fairy tales. These are little stories he made up.
Right.
Whereas the Grimm tales, nobody wrote those. Those are the Grimm brothers' attempt to create, to collect a mythology to equal that of the Greeks. And so what they did is very scientifically went around, collected different versions of all these stories, tried to strain out the best, most consistent story. And these are stories that grew out of a culture, out of the psyche of a culture, in effect. At least that's the way Jung would feel, and that this is a reflection of a psychological, just the psychological makeup of a culture, of a race of people, and actually they go beyond that. It's more universal there. You find these fairy tales that the Grimm collected, and then you find fairy tales collected on the other side of the world, and they'd still be the same stories, the same kind of things happening.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a fairy tale collector, a 19th century guy named Andrew Lang, who was just collecting them pretty much for the fun of it, because he just liked to put out fairy tale books for kids. And he said that one of his introductions, that the more and more he collected, the more he started to see that these were the same stories being told over and over, you know, by different cultures that have no contact with each other. But anyway, that's one objection that they have to Hans Christian Andersen. Another is that Hans Christian Andersen always can't resist telling the moral of something. He'll say, this happened, and the reason this happened is this, where the fairy tale always leaves this sense of ambiguity. There's no didacticism in a fairy tale as there would be in a story by Hans Christian Andersen. Another one difference between the emphasis that Bettelheim, you didn't mention too much, but the emphasis I sensed that he might have, and the emphasis Freud would have, Bettelheim seems to say these are psychological projections of fantasies we have about the external world, you know, fantasies we have about our parents or things like that. Whereas Jung would say these are projections of psychological processes, and that's and any connections it would have with the external world are also symbolic of these internal processes, like these mothers that turn up, bad mothers, good mothers that turn up in these tales. Well, they may have some correspondence to mothers in the real world, but really these are corresponding to different elements of the unconscious, and that these different characters in the story are corresponding to elements of our unconscious self. The hero, for instance, is usually the ego. You know, the ego going off into this adventure into the unconscious, slaying the dragon, the devouring beast of the unconscious from which he originally had sprung himself. And another difference that you and I have talked about before is just that Jung isn't so reductionistic with his interpretation. It doesn't come out sounding like a neat little formula. And he leaves a lot of mystery in it. He just says that these are different metaphors for something that's ultimately unknowable.
Yeah.
These projections are the best expression we can give to that which is unknowable. And Freud wouldn't say that at all. Freud would say, this is it, and it's all boiled down to sex in the end. The best thing we can do is beat back the ego. I mean, the id, you know, the ego should beat back the id. And Jung doesn't say that at all. Jung wants to integrate the unconscious and the conscious world, and the id is not something evil to be tamed and conquered and in effect, destroyed.
Yeah, he does get very specific. For instance, in Sleeping Beauty, you know, where she's been given all of these gifts by the good fairies and so forth. But the 12th fairy or whoever it is says that she will prick her finger and she will die. And then the 13th fairy also has a wish or something. Well, she won't die, but she'll sleep for 100 years. Well, then at the age of 12 or 13, whatever it is, and it is just approaching puberty and everything, then she finds her way up in the castle itself, up to the very top in this little room, and there she finds an old lady who is spinning, and she pricks her finger, and so then Freud would say that this is menstruation, goes into a deep sleep, and it's the passivity and so forth of adolescence and so forth, and the thorns grow up around the castle and everything, and it isn't, and many suitors come through and try and get her to awaken her and so forth, but it isn't until the time is right and the 100 years are up, even though it seems like 100 years, it is only, you know, the period of adolescence isn't chopped through the brush and so forth, and awakens her. And so he will be very specific on many of those things, you know, what is that little room up there, and who, you know, and all of these things where I think that Jung probably does. Well, I didn't know so much about it myself. I'll probably go and read a few more books, but thank you all for coming.